Let's talk about the liabilities.
I'm thinking how to make this make sense in the limited amount of time that we have left. This is a presentation that could take all day, really. But think about it this way. The same forces that impact the assets impact the shares and deposits. It's complicated, and there's a lot of what ifs in there. We have to estimate, for example, how long your non-maturity shares are actually going to stay in the credit union, because theoretically we know that they some will stay, and we know that they won't all leave tomorrow. Theoretically, they could all leave and decay or run off overnight, but we know that in fact some of those deposits and shares are really long term. They're not going to ever leave until the member dies or retires and spends them or something like that. Some of your deposits and shares have a shorter decay rate, but we have to estimate how long you're going to have the use of that money, and we have to estimate how rate sensitive that money is, because we know that the rate sensitivity on the shares is varied, and you won't necessarily raise your rates if rates go up. During that time frame that I demonstrated earlier in the webinar, when rates went up 300 to 500 basis points in 04 to 06, credit union share rates only went up 100 to 150 basis points in a lot of cases. And that works very, very much in your favor. And the reason for that is the same economic factors that impact assets impact deposits. And depending on the assumptions that we've made, the economic value of the liability will go down. But unlike when the outlook when an asset is devalued, the outlook when a liability is devalued it's a good thing, isn't it? If a liability is devalued, don't let the door hit you on the way out. That's a good thing if your liabilities are devalued. So what it really boils down to is the credit union is in a position where it is borrowing money from its members at a much lower rate than it could actually go out and borrow that money in the wholesale market, say from a corporate or from the Federal Home Loan Bank. And we're putting a monetary value on that ability to borrow retail versus borrow wholesale. We're looking at the value of being able to borrow money from members at, for right now, near zero, effectively at zero. I was visiting with a credit union yesterday, as a matter of fact. Actually, it was Monday. Their dividend rate is 2 basis points. 2 basis points. And money is still coming into the credit union. If they had to go out and borrow that money for a couple, 3 years, they'd probably have to pay 100 to 200 basis points for that money. So that's the value we're assigning to their shares. And the value that value that we assign to your non-maturity shares offsets some of the interest rate risk when rates rise, because it's just funds that you have that you don't have to raise the rates on. I don't know if I explained that very well or not. It's a complicated subject, but let me give you an example, a real-life example. This isn't just something I set and made up one night. This is a real-life example, and I'm familiar with the example because it's a local bank here in Utah where I live, down in central Utah. And the name of the bank was the Bank of Ephraim. And this is all public information, so I'm not telling stories out of school here. The Bank of Ephraim failed. And usually when a bank fails, and this is true, this is a bank, but it doesn't matter. These principles apply to banks and credit unions. It was a small community bank, much like a credit union. But it doesn't matter that it was a bank. The same principles apply exactly the same way to credit unions. So when the bank fails, usually what the FDIC does is they go in and they package up the bank, and usually they close the bank on a Friday, and usually by Monday morning they've been working this deal for a while behind the scenes. They make a deal with some other bank, and the bank reopens with a new sign out in front, and everybody's happy. They sell the assuming bank the assets and the liabilities, and there's usually some cash changes hands one way or the other, in one direction or the other, and that happens. But in this case, the assets were so crappy, this is my understanding, that the FDIC decided not to sell the assets immediately. They thought they could rehabilitate some of the assets and sell them later and not take such a big hit. But they still had these $41 million in insured deposits that they had to do something with. They knew that they were on the hook. There was no question they were on the hook. This is the liability on their books. This is the liability on the books of the FDIC. We owe these people $41 million. I don't know how many depositors they had, but there were obviously thousands of them. And we have to make that money available to them. So what would be their choices? What would be the FDIC's choices? Well, their choices would be to write everybody a check for a total of $41 million and put an ad in the newspaper and say, you know, you can either come down to the bank Monday morning and pick up your check, or if you want cash, we'll give you cash. And they could have ordered $41 million in from the Fed and just have people line up and get their cash. But there's a better way, because those deposits have value. So after a bidding war, and a large bank agreed to accept the $41 million liability, and was only paid $36 million to accept that liability. In other words, the surviving bank, the bank that actually accepted these liabilities and opened their doors and says, okay, you $41 million worth of deposits, it's in our bank now. You can come and get it if you want or not. And of course, they know most of them won't. But they booked $41 million worth of a liability on the bank's books. And they only got paid $36 million to do that. Why would they do that? Ask yourself that. Why would they do that? Why would they accept the liability of $41 million and the FDIC only gave them $36 million? And the answer was the deposits were worth $5 million. The relationships and the present value and the market value of the deposits came to, in their eyes, $5 million. And so there's an example, a very concrete example of a case where an actual price tag was put on deposits. It's a somewhat unique case because usually it all gets packaged up and goes as a bundle. But in this case, the deposits were sold separately, and the price of the deposits in this failed bank were worth $5 million to another institution that wanted to come in and set up shop in that part of the state. So hopefully that kind of clears up the fog for you a little bit. It's like I say, the concept of NEV is more problematical than income simulation, but it's still important.